Though it had little or nothing to do with Australia, the mutiny on the Bounty has become one of the foundational stories of the nation. So many novels, so many films, so many histories, and now a wonderful document, the Pitcairn Island Register, lent by the National Maritime Museum at Greenwich to the descendants of the mutineers now living on Norfolk Island. Its full title, The Pitcairn Island Register, From the Destruction of the Bounty Up to the Present Time, begun in 1823. It begins with a few sad lines on the fate of the mutineers. Where are they now, the infatuated band, whose outraged feelings urged them on to crime? Prescribed, they wandered on from land to land, to Pitcairn came and perished in their prime. Well, not all of them, not the women and children and their descendants, who include Dr. Pauline Reynolds, Chair of the Norfolk Island Museums Trust and Adjunct Fellow at Macquarie University, who negotiated with Greenwich for the long loan of the register. Pauline joins me now, and with her is Helen Mears, Head of Curatorship and Research at Greenwich. Helen is deeply interested in the decolonising of museum practice, and she carried the register from Britain to Norfolk Island. Pauline, welcome. Helen, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Helen, the document itself, what does it look like? What sort of state is it in?
In some ways, for an object of such great significance, there's something quite unprepossessing about it. It's a bound volume. We think the binding was applied later. So it's a manuscript. It's a handwritten volume of quite slender size. And it's currently installed at the Pier Store, part of Norfolk Island Museums.
They stopped using it on Pitcairn when the document became so dilapidated and waterlogged that it wasn't much use anymore. I take it it's been repaired.
It's actually in very good condition for its age and particularly for its provenance. And so it's quite perhaps more robust than one might think. And the water damage is evident. There's a sort of band of, yes, of water staining across the top, but not as dilapidated as the as George Hun Nob's comments might suggest.
But Pauline, how did you find out about this document?
Well, it was in 2022 that actually the great-great-grandson of John Buffett, who was actually the scribe of the register, he was looking online and he actually discovered that the register was there at the National Maritime Museum. I had actually seen it in 2010 and I had never had the idea to bring it to Norfolk, but that was Mervyn Buffett's very strong wish that it come to the community on Norfolk Island, the descendants of the people that are written about in the register.
1787, the Bounty leaves England and goes off to collect breadfruit from Tahiti. And they all have a wonderful time in Tahiti. Is that right?
Well, in 1788, in October, the Bounty actually arrived on the shores of Tahiti and they stayed there for 5 months, and that was the longest that any foreign ship had ever been stayed in Tahiti. And so, of course, during that time, relationships began, friendships, allyships, and also romances. So, and then, of course, after 5 months, they left, and as they sailed up near the island of Tonga, the crew mutinied, and that story has become incredibly famous,
yes,
in naval maritime history, of course.
And the men take the Bounty back to Tahiti for a bit, and then finally they end up in Pitcairn. How many people came ashore at Pitcairn before they burnt the Bounty?
Okay, so there were 9 mutineers and there were 12 women and a baby girl and 6 Polynesian men. So they were overwhelmingly a Polynesian group of settlers, and but the British sailors, of course, had the power, I suppose.
Well, they had the power, but things were pretty grim for the sailors and for the Tahitian men. I mean, essentially, they just slaughtered one another, didn't they?
That is true. Yes, in the first 3 years, most of the men were killed. And by Christmas Day, 1800, the year 1800, there was only one man left, and that was John Adams.
So there they are, all on the island. And then in 1823, there's a passing whaling boat, and ashore comes...
This is John Buffett, the original author of the Register, who starts the author. So he's a Bristol shipwright and a very talented carpenter. And he comes aboard and becomes an instructor, a source of educational and religious guidance to the community.
But the really important thing is that this is 30 years after the mutineers came to Pitcairn. But Buffett mm-hmm. decides... to get their stories from the moment of the landing. And therefore, he is writing the first history, is he not?
The first ship to come across Pitcairn was in 1808, and that was the Topaz. And that was, it was a sealing ship. And so they came across the community and they wrote about the community. So from 1808 up until 1823, it's not very long, ships captains and sailors had become really, really interested. And so there were some records, but the Pitcairn Register is the first record from within the community, and that's what's really important.
And it's not just births, deaths and marriages. It's also... murders, suicides, everything is there. In very, very shorthand, but it's there.
Yes, but getting beyond the gore, there's also this underlying story of women raising children and many children being born and the entertaining ships that came in and taking care of people as they came onto the island.
And I know that this is what interests you, that so much of the story of the mutiny has been written about the men and their crimes, their deaths, etc., etc., etc. But the whole thing only succeeds. Is this right, Pauline? The whole thing only succeeds because of the women.
Yes, well, when they arrived in 1790, it was January 1790, so the heat of summer, they arrived at a Polynesian island, so they recognised the plants, they recognised the birds and the fish, and because there was also Polynesian men that came with them, but they did understand how that island worked. They were islanders themselves and familiar with what was there already. I do believe that those British men would not have survived on their own. They didn't have... Those women brought... a particular kind of knowledge with them that was absolutely needed.
They did try to get away at one stage.
Yes, the women did rip off the boards of some of their houses and they built a raft and tried to leave. It was probably only the women that didn't have children. Not all of the women had children. So six of the women had children, six didn't. And I mean, that was an incredibly brave act. And of course, it unfortunately or fortunately, I'm not sure, broke
yes.
apart and they didn't get anywhere. But I mean, yes, of course, incredibly brave that they wanted to brave the elements and try to get to the closest island.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Maher and I'm talking to Pauline Reynolds, Chair of the Norfolk Island Museums Trust, and Helen Mears, Head of Curatorship and Research at the Royal Museums of Greenwich, about this extraordinary book, The Pitcairn Register. Pauline, the survival of the book now depends on missionaries. How is it that the book gets from Pitcairn to Britain?
It's a really wonderful story, actually. So in 1852, by then, George Hun Nobbs, who was another Englishman that settled amongst the islanders and married into a family, the Christian family, my family, he was visited by Fairfax Moresby, who arrived and then said to him, "You need to be ordained as a minister." So he actually paid for him to get to England. And so in the time that he was going to be gone, they asked the Reverend Holman, who was aboard that ship, I think it's the Portland. And so the Reverend Holman stayed on the island, and he was actually became the third scribe that's in the book. So there's three writers in that book. And so then he went away, Nobbs went away, Holman's there, and then they have the first steamer to ever visit the island, the Virago, and the captain of the steamer offered the whole population to go around the island, to do a tour around the island. And, of course, the Reverend Holman was very excited and took the register with him and then accidentally dropped it into the water. Oh. They must have gotten it out pretty quickly because it's not so badly damaged, all that we can see today anyway. Mm. Obviously, some great conservation has gone into the book. So then when George Hunt Nobbs returned to the island a few months later, he kept writing in it until 1854, and then he decided that it needed to be sent to his good friend, the Reverend Murray in London, who was a secretary for the Society of the Promotion of Christian Knowledge, and it ended up in their collections.
And Helen, how did it get from there to Greenwich?
So the Society, moving on in time, the Society loaned it to the museum, to the National Maritime Museum in 1989 for the exhibition Mutiny on the Bounty, which marked the 200th anniversary since the mutiny. So they generously loaned it for the exhibition. And then just less than a decade later, in 1998, the Society gifted it to what was then Royal Museums Greenwich to mark the Society's 300th anniversary. And since then, it's remained in the collection. And since 2018, it's been on display in the museum's Pacific Encounters Gallery.
So this is a story which is so familiar in research of a document which is actually quite famous, coming to the attention of the people for whom it is really, that it really, really matters, led by you, Pauline, and the linking up of the two. But Pauline, when did you start to try to work out who the women in your family were? Was it after you discovered the register, or had this been going on for some time already?
Oh, at least 30-odd years ago, I was here on Norfolk Island. I was learning to dance. I was sitting in a circle with some beautiful women at our centre, and one of the elder women said, "What about Dem Wahine on our bounty? What about those women on the bounty?" And that was the thing that triggered something inside me. Later on, I visited Tahiti, and then after that, I went back and I lived there and I raised my two children. And I think living there, I tried to find, how could I find the traces of these women? I was confused that we didn't know their names, that we didn't speak much about them because we didn't know much about them. And so that began my journey. So I started looking for the cloth, or tupper cloth is what we call it, or bark cloth, that they made, and I contacted museums around the world to see if they had any in their collections. And fortunately, I've found about 60 or 70 so far.
And that cloth tells you the story of your family?
That cloth is the remnant of those women. There's nothing that exists except their DNA in me and our community, but also they've left their words in our language, and they're cooking in the food that we cook, and remnant parts of our culture, the weaving that we do. But what I wanted to find was material culture. And the interesting thing about tupper cloth, the tupper cloth that they made, is it has indications of their kind of position in society by the dyes that they used, by the fineness of the cloth that they made. They were really elite makers of bark cloth.
Was it your idea that the register should go to Norfolk Island, where where the mutineers' descendants had shifted when, in about 1850, something like that, they moved from Pitcairn to Norfolk?
It wasn't my idea to bring the register to Norfolk Island. It was Mervyn Buffett, who is the great-great-grandson of John Buffett, the original scribe of
yes.
the register, and his partner Claire. And they approached the Norfolk Island Museum Trust, basically. There was, you know, quite a bit of discussion on how to go about this. But first of all, they actually approached the National Maritime Museum and the Royal Museums Greenwich, and that was the beginning of an amazing relationship.
Helen, what was the response of your museum to this request?
I think wholehearted support and interest, as you've outlined, the kind of basic outline of the history of the mutiny is well known to those of us in the UK. But this sort of, I think the legacies of that history, the fact that there were communities still, you know, the descendants were still living on Pitcairn and on Norfolk Island, was really compelling. And so what started as a very short email from Mervyn Buffett became a much longer and more complex and involved conversation between colleagues at the National Maritime Museum and colleagues here, our peers here, both Merv and his partner Claire, but also Norfolk Island Museum Trust and also Norfolk Island Council of Elders. So it became a much more involved and sustained conversation that spanned several years now.
Yeah.
And Helen, what could the museum do? Could it give the register to the islanders?
Like many national museums in Britain, in England, the National Maritime Museum is bound by the terms of its founding act, the National Maritime Museum Act of 1934. And Merv and Claire's ambitions was to see the register transferred fully to Norfolk Island Museum Trust. The terms of the National Maritime Museums Act only allow for what's termed disposal, also deaccession and transfer, in very specific circumstances, whether something's a duplicate item, whether it's in really poor condition, whether it has no potential for display or research, or objects that pose a specific health and safety risk. There isn't currently scope to look at deaccession on an ethical or moral basis. And that's a situation that obviously is familiar to many people in terms of the British Museum, the V&A. But we have been fully committed throughout to taking the opportunity of building a strong and cooperative relationship with stakeholders here on Norfolk Island. And I should mention also Pitcairn Island. We hosted the then mayor, Simon Young, at the museum last year, and seeking to develop a really strong relationship and also exploring opportunities for knowledge sharing, which is something ongoing as I'm here in Norfolk Island at present.
Pauline, what was the response of the people on Norfolk Island to seeing the register itself? I mean, they knew of it and you could go online and, you know, get the details, but to see the book itself?
Incredibly emotional. It's been a very unifying journey to get here. So we've, you know, the community was absolutely activated to fundraise and to support in kind and in many different ways to get it here. So we had an unveiling event on last Friday, last week, and we had well over 100 people in a very small space. And what was really important, what I really want to say, is the community sees the Pitcairn Register as our book of origins. It contains our genealogy. It explains how we are an Anglo-Polynesian people. We are Indigenous to the Pacific. It shows how our language and our culture came to be and how we are a unique people. And so we all feel very, very proud to have this book here, this book of origins, here on our shores, on our land, and that we're able to go and visit 6 days a week down at the museum. It's very, very fulfilling and incredibly grounding and exciting at the same time.
Pauline, you've written a song about the story of the women. What does the song say?
The song is actually just the names of the women. So it actually took quite a bit of research to find these names and then put them into the context, because they were written mostly by English men. So I had to work through how they were actually written in Tahitian. So the song is actually the names of the women. It's called Tupuna Wahine, which means ancestresses, and they deserve to be remembered and named and sung for.
And your daughter has sung the song.
Yes, she has.
Let's hear the song now.
Moatua, moatua, moatua wahine ye, e. Moatua e, te ehu, te atu.
Helen, Pauline, thank you very much for joining us for this conversation. To mark the return of the Register to Norfolk Island, Helen Mears, Head of Curatorship and Research at Royal Museums Greenwich, and Dr. Pauline Reynolds, Chair of the Norfolk Island Museums Trust. This is Late Night Live.
Te raura mata ohu taupiti e. Te raura e, te atu ahitia, te rahu to imata e.